KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we welcome back an old friend, master chef and cookbook author Jacques Pepin joins us to discuss the cooking and preparing of fast food his way, which is not the fast food you buy under the golden arches or from a colonel. The former personal chef to Charles de Gaulle and contributing editor of Food and Wine and star of 11 public television cooking series shows, he'll join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to Forum. World-famous cooking teacher and award-winning chef Jacques Pepin, the star of 11 cooking series shows on public broadcasting, has published 25 cookbooks and was personal chef to French President Charles de Gaulle. He's a contributing editor to Food and Wine and dean of special programs at the French Culinary Institute in New York, as well as a teacher at Boston University, and has a new book out called More Fast Food My Way. And he joins us for this Forum Hour, and welcome home is what I want to say.
Thank
to
you, Jacques. Yes. It feels like home.
Good. So good to have you here. A lot of people don't know that your shows are recorded here.
Yeah, the show I recorded that starting of it, well, about 20 years ago, actually, 1988, something like this.
Yeah. Well, we're always pleased to have you here, and pleased to look at this new book, too, as many people are, because... Well, you know, with the time constraints that people have, they want to put perhaps less time into preparing food and into cooking food. And from what I've been reading, more people are using this book than yes. all of your previous books.
It's true, because it's closer to the way maybe people cooked, and they can use it very easily. And it's also using the supermarket a great deal more than I used to. I'm probably known for a book like La Technique or The Art of Cooking, which I believe is probably my best book, also the one who sold the least probably, where I actually went fishing in Long Island Sound to get a skate, to show you how to take the wing out of skate, and so forth. I mean, I did everything from the beginning for a chef. This is at the antipode of this, because I use the supermarket as a prep cook. And as you know, in a professional kitchen, you have la mise en place, what we call la mise en place, which is the prep cook who comes in the morning and bone out the chicken, bone out the fish, chop the shallot, slice the mushroom, wash the spinach, so that by the time you stand at the stove ready for the first order, everything is in front of you, uncooked, fresh. Then you have an order for a fish, you grab a fillet of sole, a bit of shallot, a bit of sliced mushroom on it, a bit of white wine, cook it a minute, minute and a half, remove it, reduce the juice, and finish that dish in 5, 6, 7 minutes because someone has prepared that for you. So I do use the supermarket in the same way. I can go and buy a skinless and boneless breast of chicken, pre-sliced mushroom, pre-washed spinach, pre-washed salad, dry out, and with a non-stick pan, and I put a timer on it, so within 5, 6, 7 minutes, I have a dish from scratch, which is quite different than a dish from scratch when I was an apprentice 60 years ago.
Yeah, the supermarkets make it easy now to do yes. things quickly, but you also point out in your book that it's good to have the right equipment. What do you need for this kind of fast food that you're talking about here? What should you really have?
Well, good equipment is good equipment. Certainly, you know, a good knife, and by a good knife, I mean a one which is sharp. It can be any brand, but if you don't keep it sharp, it's useless. And a good board, a cutting board, as well as a good pat and a good source of it. I mean, basically, that's what we need. But a couple of good pat goes a long way. Thick, heavy aluminum pan, some of them with a permanent non-stick type of cover, and you can do a lot in it. Also, cut down on the amount of fat and all that you use if you have those type of pat.
You've always cooked fast, haven't you?
Yes. I mean, this is not a new way of cooking. Everyone does that. My mother cooked this way. My French chef cooked this way. Sure, Thomas Keller cooked this way. Occasionally, that is. You may cook over the weekend for hours, and then come Tuesday or Wednesday, you go shopping somewhere, come home at 5 o'clock, you say, I'm hungry. You look in your pantry and find a can of cannellini beans and forage through the freezer to find a chorizo, slice it on top and do a soup in 5-6 minutes, because this is that type of day. So what I did in that book is to try to extrapolate those recipes who lend themselves to that type of cooking and do a book out of it to make people's life easier so they can spend more time sitting in the kitchen with the kid and the spouse rather than in the kitchen.
Well, you mentioned your mother. There's you break this book down into soups and eggs and fish and shellfish and poultry and meat and vegetables and potatoes and other things of that sort, pasta, pizza, all the things that I can't eat now as a new diabetic, but and desserts likewise. But there's also there's a stew that you write about that's just peas and carrots, and you say you like to make it because it reminds you of your mother. You get the smell of your mother.
Sure,
in his kitchen,
sure,
yeah.
Absolutely. I think it was a Chinese philosopher who said, "What is patriotism but the taste of the dish you had as a child?" I mean, that's paraphrasing, but and there is a great deal of truth in this. You know, those tastes remain for you the rest of your life, and there is no place more secure for a child, I believe, coming back from school, to sit in the kitchen, do your own work, and then you have those smell of the kitchen, the cling, the noise of the kitchen, the voice of your mother, your father, and those will remain for you forever. And in time of stress particularly, I mean, when I think of those kids in Iraq or in Afghanistan, you know, what do they think of their mother's apple pie or clam chowder or one of those things? Because that's comfort, that's security, and that's important.
Speaking of clam chowder, you've got a recipe for that in here. I once was asked to be a judge in Santa Cruz of clam chowder. And it was some of the worst tasting. I felt like I was, you know, sampling things from a toxic dump or something along those. I don't mean to insult anybody, but it was just absolutely dreadful. You've got a wonderful clam chowder recipe here.
Yes, I use actually clam twice this way. I live in on the coast of Connecticut, and we do get a lot of clams as well as oyster, lobster in summer. And for me, the clam were always tough, most of the time. And the point is that when we used to do them, when I worked for Howard Johnson, then they were retorted, that is cooked for a long time under high pressure, and at that point they get tender. And it's that way with many, many things. You know, you can have a beautiful steak, you saute it in a skillet or grill it, and it's very tender. In your skillet, if you put half a cup of water or wine and you cover it, boil it 2 minutes, it will curl up like a piece of leather and be tough like a piece of leather. But then you boil it, you continue cooking it for an hour and a half, you have a beef burgundy, and it's that tender. The point is that you cannot go in between, and often that's what happens with clam. You boil them 4 or 5 minutes, and they get really, really tough. So in those books, I use them raw. Basically, I like raw clam. Just warm them up. Even on a clam that I put in the oven, and I do the same thing for that soup. I open the clam like you would them on the half shell and put them in an oven at like 180, 200 degrees, like where you warm your plate. During that time, I saute a little bit of, maybe if I do, I think I may use a bit of bacon and onion or shallot, whatever. And when it comes out of the oven, up, I put a tablespoon of that on top. You serve them. So they're just warm enough not to be cold, and with that mixture on top, and they're absolutely delicious. And likewise with the soup, I'll do the base of the soup, which I think I do with leek here and stock and milk maybe and garlic and so forth. And at the last moment, you know, you put your clam in the very hot plate and pour the hot bouillon on top of it. Of course, you put the liquid of the clam into the soup. So those clams are tender this way.
And you talk about how these meals can be, these fast meals can be pretty elegant.
Oh, yes. Quite elegant, actually. You know, elegance very often has to do with other things than the dish itself. What I'm talking about is that if I roast a chicken at home, I will roast it the right way, baste it, and I sit down in the kitchen with my wife, and this is country cooking. And then if people come for lunch, then I move it to the dining room, I add a salad, and this is bourgeois cooking or whatever. And by the time I deglaze it with a bit of cognac, put some mushroom around, and put flowers on the table, open a bottle of champagne, and put a tie, this is haute cuisine. You know, so you can move the dish in different directions with the same dish.
We're talking to Jacques Pepin. His new book is More Fast Food My Way, and of course he's known to many as the star of public television, one of the stars of public television for the cooking shows that he's done through the years. People always ask about your daughter. How is she?
Yes. Claudine is great. Claudine lives in Denver. She has a little cooking school. This is what happened when she went to Boston University and went into graduate school in political science, spent a year in Brussels to do some type of thesis on the defense of Europe, and start selling wine. Now she's cooking.
She didn't take a course from you at Boston University.
No, absolutely not. No.
There are a number of dishes here that and people will call, obviously, just to have the chance to talk to you. But there's like that will save not only time, because some of these things can be done in a minute, but also
yes.
money. Like turkey scallopini.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, because veal is getting more expensive.
Absolutely. And if you do it a certain way, I don't remember exactly what I did in there, but if you deglaze it with a little bit of...
We got morels.
And then you have morel in it too, so the mushroom will dominate, and those are very tender, and that's going to be a very satisfying dish. I mean, we call it fast food my way. It's a catchword, fast food. Maybe it's more accurate to say food fast my way.
No. But in the face of the slow food really movement, or people associate fast food, of course, with golden arches or clowns or colonels.
We are a country of extreme. You know, we have the microwave oven to cook very, very fast. We have the slow crock cookery pot to cook very, very slow. And we get the regular stove to cook very, very seldom, somewhere in between. You know, so this is the way it works.
What do you think about the slow food movement?
I think it's great. You know, if I wanted to extrapolate, as I did for that book, I extrapolate recipes which are fast to create that type of book, I could in my cooking extrapolate recipes which take me a long time to do that I braise slowly, and I would have a book on slow food. You know, so yes, it's all part of cooking. It's not like you cook one way only all the time.
A number of years ago, we did an interview with Julia Child. I was one of two of you at the Mark Hopkins, in fact, and... she was extolling meat, you know, as she was wont to do, and saying, you know, there's too much emphasis on how meat is bad for you, and she was really being the champion of meat that she...
Absolutely.
What do you say to these people who say, you know, meat's unhealthy and we should eat a lot less meat? And,
right. So what I would say, you're absolutely right. If that's how you feel, then eat less meat. But don't tell me what to do because I like meat occasionally you know, a good steak. I mean, certainly during the time of Nouvelle Cuisine and we started to grill everything on the Julia, I would say, this is the worst thing you can do. I mean, the vegetable on the grill are burned and raw. She said two things that you cannot have. And in many ways, she was right, you know.
There's a dish that you have in here, shrimp with cabbage and red caviar, 10 minutes. And
yes.
You developed it for the Russian Tea Room?
Yes, I used to be a consultant at the Russian Tea Room in New York for a number of years. So it's an idea in a case like that, Russian food, you're going to have cabbage, you have something sour, like sour cream and all that goes well with it, caviar, of course. So to put those ingredients together, so, you know, you shred a cabbage and you sauté it very briefly, deglaze it with a little bit of cream at the end, place your shrimp at the end and cover it with some caviar, you know, you have red caviar as well as black caviar if you can afford it. In fact, I have a caviar. I'm making a Payushnaya now with the California Caviar Company, which is actually in San Francisco here. And the Payushnaya is a pressed caviar, you know, that we used to have in Russia. And when I was a kid, we used to use it in France. When I was at the Pavilion in New York, we used it. And when I was at the Russian Tea Room, we used it. That was in the 80s. And some strange reason, it disappeared. And I'm amazed. I speak with young chefs now. I say, you know what pressed caviar or payushnaya is? No, never heard of it. And it's used usually with, they use the Ocetra, hackleback, paddlefish, all of the black caviar, I mean the black sturgeon. And one at the end of the run when the eggs are broken or the eggs are unripe, they put all together, resalt it and press it. So it becomes like tar, very thick. And for an aficionado of caviar, extremely concentrated in taste, my wife loves it. And so it's great. You can take a little teaspoon of it and you can roll it between plastic wrap and make like a cookie out of it or doing things. And so I have a great deal of fun with that.
Yeah, speaking about aficionados of caviar, I remember having dinner once at Narcy David's and he had all these different caviars.
Yes,
and
yes,
what
yes.
a lover of caviar he was. But
yes.
saying that the Russian caviar is the best, really, isn't it?
Yes, but this year, the Russian caviar from in New York, I got a triple zero Beluga, which is the greatest. I didn't get it. I got the price list. It was $10,000 a kilo. You know. I mean...
Oh, and all that petroleum money they have as well.
My God.
Did you do fast food cooking for De Gaulle?
Absolutely. There are dishes that will always be the same. I mean, starting with a tomato salad, you know, with the... Yes, there is always certain dish in the repertoire which are much better than fast. Certainly a great deal of salad. Don't take well to putting the seasoning or the dressing ahead. It will get wilted. Certainly like watercress and all that, or arugula, you know, it gets wilted in seconds. So those type of dish you do just at the last moment and serve them. When you cook, I mean, when I cook for the president in France and for De Gaulle, I dealt with Madame De Gaulle. You always deal with the lady of the house. And for the menu during the week, and certainly the Sunday meal, which they were going to church. They were devout Catholic. And after church, there was children and grandchildren who came every Sunday. So we did that dinner, which I set up under the guidance of Madame de Gaulle. I have to say that at the end of the month, when I had to send my accounting for what we spent during the month, I had to send a special accounting to Madame de Gaulle for that Sunday meal that they would pay from their own pocket. It was a question of principle with the president. So you do have to admire it, because it was basically a drop of water in what we spent in reception during the month. But when I did dinner for state people, like I serve Nehru, Tito, Eisenhower, Macmillan, we are the head of state at the time, then usually you deal with the protocol who tell you how long the dinner has to be, how important it is, if there is any, you know, religion restriction or other type of things, you know, dietary restrictions. So you deal with that and create a menu, or if the president has invited someone before and have the same fish already served twice. So, you know, all of that is work usually with the protocol people.
I was just thinking about how it must be to cook for someone like Charles de Gaulle as opposed to, you know, Bill Clinton, who liked Big Macs, or for that matter, George Bush, who likes Tex-Mex food, right?
Yes, but I think the taste, the personal taste of the president, I think should be transcended in the sense when he represents a country. It should represent the best of a country in the best way, in the classical tradition of that country, regardless of the personal taste of the president. When you have foreign dignitary coming, you know.
Do you go to their national? Or do you go to their national cuisines? Then would that be de rigueur to go to their?
Well, no. I mean, if I serve, you know, the Prime Minister of India, I may do a very classical French dish because I represent France during the time when I was there. But I may put a touch of maybe garam masala or something else in one of the dish just to, you know, to give it a little clin d'œil, you know, if you want.
Talking again with Jacques Pepin. And by the way, more Fast Food My Way airs on KQED TV Saturday mornings at 10:30. But we're talking about the book that is based on the series, a whole chapter on eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I love eggs. I mean, eggs, you know, it's interesting enough because 10 years ago, the National Health Institute had restricted the eggs to like one a week. Now we are back to one a day, or some people say even two a day. So you get crazy with those guidelines. But certainly eggs of good quality, and now even in normal supermarket you can get organic eggs. I go to a farm to get my eggs in Connecticut where the chicken are running around, so they are happy, they're eating warm and grass, and so they give me good eggs. And that does make a difference. You know, we did a book a year ago or so called The Last Supper, and there were like 50 chefs giving the last supper that you would have. And I forget all of what I have, but certainly I had ham and egg included in it, you know, because I love eggs. I love ham of the best quality with the best quality butter. This is really great food.
You were mentioning chickens being well-treated, and before you said, you know, you don't want anybody interfering with your eating meat, even though there are some who would like to have meat taken from our diets. Uh-huh. What about the whole controversy over foie gras?
Well, the foie gras, I think, is way, way overblown, and there is different reason for it. I mean, the foie gras was discovered by the Egyptian long before the French, and they realized that at the time of migration, there is two birds, you know, the goose, as well as the duck, which before migration will gorge themselves to prepare for the 6 weeks or 7 weeks migration that they have to do. And at that time, the liver gets really inflated, double almost in size, and is extremely succulent at that time. And by the time the animal gets back to where it goes, the liver goes back to a normal size. So it is not, as people have said, that you gorge an animal and you distort his liver and you make sickness into it. No, it's a natural process in those two birds, you know. So that being said, there is way of force feeding, and I have been in farm. A lot of people talk about it. They've never seen it done. But believe me, after one or twice that the animal is fed, it come by itself, and it fed, what, in the last 5 weeks of its life, whatever. And it come by itself and get force-fed, and normally it was done only with corn, plus the fat of duck and all that. So compare to the way, you don't want to traumatize an animal anyway, because you're not going to get good results. The animal should be respected and properly killed. And if a farmer gives protection to a chicken, preventing the weasel or the other animal to kill that chicken and feed him every day. So it's a kind of an exchange situation where you guarantee you feed the chicken, you protect him against things, and at the end you eat it. I mean, it's a normal process the way it should be, but the animal should be treated fairly and killed fairly and so forth. This is what life is all about, I mean, in my opinion. So for the if you see the way the chicken are raised in those big farms where they have less than 1 foot of of territory, and the chicken happen to be territorial, so they blind them, they cut the beak, and they are in area with the noise is atrocious, and the life of that chicken is much worse than what you have with the farm of the duck. But of course it's very difficult to attack the poultry industry, which is very powerful, but to attack a couple of farms which have 200 or 300 duck, you know, you feel very righteous about it, and it's not dangerous.
Our guest again is Jacques Pepin, and open up the phone lines, your opportunity to speak to one of the world's greatest chefs and culinary experts. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We welcome your calls, and you can join us now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free for your calls, 866-733-6786, or feel free to send us an email with any question or comment you have, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. You had mentioned best quality butter. What kind of butter do you use or do you like?
Still, because of what I do, I tend to buy only in supermarket so that people can duplicate the dish that I do. Otherwise, if I go to special store, then people say, where am I going to get that? But, you know, Land O'Lakes, for example, Plus Gras, different type of butter that I can't find now in any supermarket are pretty good, much better than it used to be, certainly. And unsalted butter I use because the salt tend to preserve the butter, and you will notice that often salted butter is kept in the refrigerator, as often the unsalted is kept in the freezer, because it will give away its age and it will get rancid, and you will know it that you won't know it when the salt preserve it, you know.
Again, we're talking to Jacques Pepin. And by the way, I want to mention that you're wearing a button that promotes public radio.
Public radio.
To see.
I listen.
You listen, and we watch and listen to you. He'll be on Saturday mornings on Channel 9 at 10:30, and is doing his stint right here at KQED Public Radio. When we return, we'll find out what you would like to say to Jacques Pepin. And again, his newest book is More Fast Food My Way. It's a sequel to the first fast food book, not to be confused, of course, with fast food that's out there and that that people have great concern about in terms of things like diabetes and obesity. When we return, your calls and emails. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is world-famous chef and cooking book author Jacques Pepin. His new book is More Fast Food My Way, and we're going to go right to your calls here and find out what's on your mind for our guest. And we begin with you, Rich. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Jacques. Hey. How's it going? Welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you.
Just as a side note, I'm actually married to Claudine Ferlin, one of your friends, so I'm biased. But I just wanted to make a comment about your cookbook. It's the first time I've actually used a recipe in 10 years, and I'm very impressed. But I wanted to make another comment about just general cooking in this country, and households seem to be very lacking in flavors of mixed herbs and spices from around the world. And I think a lot of people, including my friends, are very, very afraid to kind of branch out and just throw things into a pot and see how it turns out. And I find that to be just the, you know, the spice of life to experiment. And I just want to know what your thoughts are on that, and what your experiences are in America living here.
Well, experiment is fine, but sometime when you just add one thing above the other just for the sake of being different or inventive,
yeah,
that's when you end up with a bowl of Roquefort with a bowl of raspberry ice cream on top or something like this,
yeah,
you know. But so sometime you go back to something very straightforward, very simple, and more satisfying. But that being said, there is no... of course, it's nice to... often cooking is defined very often by seasoning. I mean, you already have the same chicken, but if you put garam masala, then it become Indian. And if you put, peanut butter, garlic, and all that, it may be Indonesian. And nyok mam and lemongrass is going to be Vietnamese, and so forth. The chicken remained the same, so it's often defined by certain seasoning. We identify a country. I mean, when you go to Greece, you know, it's already olive oil, oregano, lemon juice. So, and that's what you want. You don't want to fool around with the dish and make it something else that it's not.
You're going to break the dish, though, if you're really eating Greek, right?
Yes.
Let me thank the caller. You have menus in the back of this book that you've constructed. What about wines for these kind of menus?
Wine is always everlasting present, you know. In what? Yes, certainly. You start with the cooking itself. Having a glass of wine makes it go easier, and that's what I do. I've been married 43 years, and when I start cooking in the afternoon or early evening, if my wife doesn't get to the stove at some point, I have to, and sometimes we cook together, but we start with a glass of wine and eventually sit down with a bottle of red wine for dinner, which we do. So this is part of our tradition, and certainly an important part of our tradition.
And our tradition, of course, is to take more of your calls, and we will. Dorothy from Richmond, morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Good
Jack,
morning.
Jack, I am mad about you, and
thank
I
you.
Am a chef in the Bay Area, and one of my most treasured possessions is a cookbook you signed years ago. But my question is, what do you feel about this proliferation of people on television who are not professionally trained, have limited talents, but just have sort of a celebrity effect? And I will take my answer off the air.
All right, and we thank you for the call.
Thank you. But, when I go to the Food & Wine Festival in Aspen, which is a big festival for 26 years, and I think I did it 24 years, and everyone is there, from Bobby Flay to Mario Batali to Emeril Lagasse to me and so forth. And people will come and see me and say, you know, I look at all the show on television and you're the best. And the reason they tell me that is that the people who can't stand me don't come and talk to me. Only the people who like me come and talk to me. And another group will go toward Bobby Flay and say, you know, I look at all the show, you are the best. So my point is that we all have people who are interested in what we do, who can identify with one person more than with one another. For me, a lot of people who cook, as you say, on television, don't really have that much knowledge of cooking, but they're having fun doing it. They bring a lot of people into cooking, and it's fine with me. I mean, I am who I am, and I cannot escape myself anyway, so I may as well be who I am and do the way I do. Some people like it. Some really don't care much. Some don't like it. There is no way you can please everybody. So, I think it's great.
Well, you keep your modesty and your humility intact.
No, I'm not modest.
You remember the last time you were on, you were with the woman who runs the French Culinary Institute.
Oh, Dorothy.
Dorothy,
yes, yeah.
And another Dorothy. The caller's name was Dorothy, too. And she said walking with you is like walking with a rock star. I mean, because everybody knows who you
really
are.
We all live in mini world, you know. So in the mini world of cooking, people may know me. You step outside of that world in the world of, I don't know, medicine or architecture. They would say, with that guy, you know.
Michael, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, Jacques.
Hi, how are you?
Ça va?
Ça va, merci.
My wife is from Paris, grew up in Toulon,
mm.
And I was wondering She's always criticizing me about many things, of course. But
all those French women, you know.
And Michael, you should be ashamed of yourself. His last name is not is I-N is pronounced "ah" in French.
Uh huh.
Anyway, I wanted to know.
Now, would you say Pepin or Pepin or Pepin? Oh. I mean, I can anglicize it. I can gallicize it. Yes. Whatever you want, right?
Pepin.
It's all right. My name goes from Jacques Pepin to Jacques Pepino. So somewhere in between.
Jacques. Yeah, Jacques I like.
Yes. But Mike, I learned from your wonderful, you are quite a linguist. I mean, as far as the English language goes. So I'm always learning from you. But anyway, Jacques, one question. Is there one specific way to make bechamel?
Well, yes. A bechamel is a white sauce, and usually it's done with about 3 tablespoons of flour and about the same amount of butter, slightly less, to 1 cup of milk to get a very thick bechamel at a base for a souffle. And then it goes from those 3 tablespoons of flour to 1 teaspoon, which is 10 times less, basically, for a very light cream sauce. So, but the process will be the same, to mix, to melt the butter and add the flour and eventually add the milk and bring it to a boil. It's always the same. The quantity of flour, as I say, depend on what you're going to do with it.
And thank you, Michael. Thank you for your kind words, too. And we'll go to Ellie. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Jacques was my cooking teacher for 8 years when he would come out west when he first started teaching.
When I worked at Charlotte Combe?
Yes, Charlotte Combe, and I was your busy buddy. I was the one who would tell you about the microwave.
Oh.
but anyway, that's neither here nor there. What I want to compliment you, Jacques, besides the marvelous technique I learned in cooking from you, your autobiography is absolutely brilliant, and I was so impressed to find out that you had the first PhD in culinary arts from Columbia University, and you created that PhD program.
Yes, I didn't. I'm sorry, but I got a master on Voltaire at Columbia, so it's far. But I teach at BU, at Boston University, and we are offering a Master of Liberal Art with a concentration in gastronomy there. So that's where I teach now, but from Colombia.
You know how Voltaire defined man?
No.
A biped without wings. I thought it was one of the best definitions I've ever heard of human.
Biped without wings, that's very good.
Ellie, you had something else you wanted to say?
The technique that Jacques teaches is amazing, and his book, La Technique, is fantastic for just a technique, because technique is everything in cooking, and it's the attitude and thinking outside the box. Mm-hmm. And you also taught me the value of healthy eggs. And that the thicker the eggshell, the more nutritious the egg. I was very impressed with that.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the call. Nice to hear from you this morning. And
you know that Voltaire also said that, do you know how difficult it would be to have to eat 3 times a day if God hadn't made it a pleasure as well as a necessity? And that's true, you know.
He also told us, didn't he, that we should tend our own gardens. One of the big lessons of life for cooking, as well as maybe for...
For cultiver son jardin, yes.
For one's own life. Here's a listener who writes, I'm a big fan of Jacques, and I'm inspired to cook now, just hearing his voice. Just as Julia Child loved McDonald's French fries, can you ask Mr. Pepin if he has a guilty pleasure he'd like to share? And Thomas Keller said on this air he likes In-N-Out. Do you have one of those kind of...
I have no guilty pleasure. Everything that I eat it with pleasure and no guilt, whether it's a hamburger from McDonald's or French fry or... I'm not crazy about marshmallow, I have to say. But when it comes to eating something, I really don't feel guilty when I eat chocolate or anything else.
Have you ever tried s'mores? Do you know about s'mores?
No.
A marshmallow with chocolate?
Oh, yes, right. Well, it's a bit better because of the chocolate, but...
Can your guest comment on how he, as a very publicly prominent chef, views the growing nexus of social justice issues with cuisine? For example, sustainability of seafood chosen, tuna overfishing, the effects of meat consumption on climate change, more important to eat less meat than to buy a Prius, and ethical treatment of animals, veal, foie gras, and... Well, we touched on this a bit. This is a listener from Chicago, though, Jim.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I mean, it's important to be sustainable. It's important to know the earth. It's important to not overfish the sea and to stop eating dangerous, I mean, species who are in danger of extinction, and all of that without any question. Even the caviar now from Russia, we should not touch it because there is basically no more beluga, et cetera, and sevriga in the Black Sea and other. That's why we turn to our domestic product. Here, all of that certainly is very, very important for a chef. The respect, too much has been said about the chef, but not enough about the farmer, because we are nothing without someone growing the food for us. And I tell you, if a farmer who lives in symbiosis with nature and knows how to raise an animal, know how to kill it properly and respect it too, I don't know any farmer who are vegetarian, by the way.
Did you read Michael Pollan's piece by any chance in the Sunday New York Times?
No, I didn't.
Whoever's next president, what food policy ought to be. It's,
oh, yes?
Have you read Omnivore's Dilemma? You haven't?
Yeah, I read
his work. And,
but I haven't read that piece in the New York Times. Well, I should.
But a lot of emphasis on the farmer and particularly getting
it
away.
It should be.
Yeah. Here's Rob, who says, thanks for another great show. Thanks, Rob. I'm trying
Thank
to get
you.
My family to eat more seafood. A two-part question. Would Jacques please explain how to buy fresh scallops? The ones I buy give up a great deal of water and then a tough. And how long does he sear them to have that great crust?
Well, if you buy those scallops which give you a lot of liquid, it's because they are placed into a special liquid to keep them fresh, and those are not very good scallops. A good scallop, like diver scallop, will be much more expensive, and there is no seeping liquid out of it, and you'll have a beautiful crust. So that's different in quality, and I would advise you, if you can, to go to a fishmonger, I mean, a place where the person knows the fish rather than the supermarket. Now, when you know the fish yourself, you can recognize the color of it. Usually, to a certain extent, it's your nose as well as your eye that will determine how fresh the fish is. And it's a question of practice. So if you start with the fishmonger who shows you the right way, you know, of recognizing good fish and not, it's a good start.
David. You're on forum. Good morning. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about professional cooking. Professional cooks, especially, I guess, line cooks, how do they time it so that, you know, they get an order for one steak, one pasta, one lobster, and how do they time it so that they all come out at the same time?
Well, it's like a ballet in the kitchen, you know, and the executive chef is the conductor. And he goes, and he will yell the order to different part of the kitchen. There is the grill man who is going to grill the fish as well as the meat and all that. There is a vegetable, someone in charge of vegetable or sauces. So the kitchen is divided between different departments. And when you have a table of six coming, each get his own order from that table of six. And at that point, at some point when the first course has been sent, the chef say, I'm going to pick up for table 12. You know, the main course. So each of the department of the kitchen is going to send their own dish so that it comes out together, which sometimes it's a little more difficult to do when you're alone at home and you have a family or guest for 8 or 10 people, and that you really have to plan it. And there is things that you can do in a restaurant and are very difficult to do at home. Sometimes the dish you have in a restaurant is done by four different departments. That is, someone will saute the fish, but the vegetable will be given to that same person by another department who does the vegetable and another one who does the sauce or some other type of garnish. Then everything comes together. At home, it's more difficult, so you have to plan differently when you do a dinner.
And I thank you for the call, David. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. I was just thinking about the fact, you know, I once asked you what the real joy was in cooking and all the time that you put in to it, and in fact,
well,
there's reference to this in my book, but you talked about memory. You talked about the memory for you and the memory for those who will be eating what you're preparing. Are you thinking,
yes,
when you've got, you know, all this pressure in the kitchen and you've got to prepare, are you thinking about the memory? Are you actually cognitively aware of memory?
It's probably more visceral, or, I don't know, maybe even genetic, in the sense that there is certain type of taste, which, for example, Claudine, my daughter, will recognize. At home, me being a father and a professional chef, but she'll go at home, she wants the mussel, the spaghetti and clam sauce that my wife does. It's better than what I can do. For her, this is that taste. then she will like something else better from me. But then she will have la soupe au vermicelle, that is the soup with a small vermicelli from her grandmother, my mother. I mean, for her, those tastes that she had as a child remain with her, and she had the... You know, she's very straight about which of those dish she liked the best from that person, or that one. And I think we all like this too. I remember tasting dishes from my aunt and all that, a roast of veal, you know, in a small cast iron thing that she would do just with 2-3 tablespoons of water at the end just to make a natural juice. I've tried all my life to do it. It never is as good or have the same taste for me, you know. So those memories are very, very powerful.
Well, there's the opposite of that, too. My mother used to cook a lot with scallions and onions, and I don't like onions.
And you don't like them?
I don't like onions. I mean, especially when they're thick and cooked thick. Or she would make a meatloaf that I really... So you get the smell sometimes from...
I don't know.
And they hit the olfactory a very different way, you know. It's negative.
Maybe there is a Freudian aspect to
what
you're saying.
Well, there must be, yeah. Well, we can talk about that. Jessica, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. What an honor it is to speak with you.
Thank you.
I wanted to let you know how much I appreciated growing up watching you on PBS, and I learned so much from you and your book, La Technique, and from Julia, of course, and from my mother, and because of the combination of the three of you, I am able to walk into a kitchen without fear and put together a meal and be confident that it will be delicious.
We don't want fear in the kitchen.
No, it doesn't turn out well. My 11-year-old son is absolutely enchanted with you, and he cannot say enough good things about you. And when you are on, he just stops everything and focuses in on your shows.
It's very gratifying, you know, sometimes children, you know, the way they look at you or... You know, there is something to cooking which is appealing to people. There is no political implication in what I do. There is no religious implication in what I do. There is no social implication. Well, social to a certain extent. So we are not dangerous. I mean, people identified with you. They can talk to you. Everyone cook. Everyone eats, at least. Not everyone cook, but everyone eats. And for me, I'm always hungry, so I always cook.
Are you always hungry? Really?
Yes. I love to eat. And... certainly, it's a very important point that you bring. You have to be happy in your kitchen. You have to be happy when you cook, and you have to be happy when you eat as well, you know. I mean, Julia used to say she'll put 2 or 3 tablespoons of butter in something and will say, oh, my God. She said, well, if you're afraid of it, don't eat it because your gastric juice are not going to work out properly and you won't digest it right. You have to be happy when you eat, and it's true. You know.
Why do you suppose, I mean, people ask me the same thing about talk show hosts, but there is a kind of gender dominance. Most chefs are males.
Well, that's not true.
Not true anymore, but for certainly...
Oh, no, that's not true before. I mean, my mother had a restaurant in Lyon, right, in France. My aunt had a restaurant in Valence. Another aunt had a restaurant in Nantua, next to the Geneva. And another cousin female had a restaurant in Lyon. That's already 4 female who had restaurant. As is now, I have my 2 cousins in Bourg-en-Bresse who have a restaurant, 2 female, and my niece next to my mother at a small restaurant in Lyon. At that point, I'm still the only one in the family, about a 6 or 7 female who have a restaurant. And the fallacy to this is that there is only 23-star restaurant in France. And yes, I think there is 1 or 2 who are female chefs, but most of them certainly are male. And that has been widely publicized coming to this country. So people will infer that all the chefs are male in France. Well, there is 138,000 restaurants in France.
Well, I should have phrased that most of the great chefs or the 5-star, 4-star chefs are male, though, right?
Yes, well, yes, it's true to a certain extent, but for example, at Lyon, where I come from, Lyon was very, very well known for the mother of Lyon. And like Bocuse, maybe considered the greatest chef in the world, apprenticed at La Mère Boisier in France, which was the mother, one of the mother of Lyon, La Mère Boisier. And still, in the 138,000 restaurants in France, there is still many more women cooking than male, certainly.
Let me go to more of our callers. If we go to Berkeley, Mike, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I really enjoyed your memoir, The Apprentice, and I read
Thank
it
you.
Around the same time as Anthony Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential, and I was really struck by the parallels,
uh-huh.
you know, for two guys who couldn't be seen more different,
uh-huh.
you know, particularly your respect for people who do the actual work of cooking,
uh-huh.
the passion. But I had a more specific question about your move to the U.S. It wasn't clear what made you decide to move.
Well, New York was, you know, the golden fleece. I mean, I wanted to go. It was the El Dorado for a young man in France. Everyone wanted to come to America. And it's true that I did not come to America under the circumstance that usually immigrant comes on. People usually come to the U.S. for economic reason, to get a better life, or religious reason, or a political problem, or a racial problem, or religious, and so forth. It wasn't not my case. I worked in Paris. I was doing pretty well. But I wanted to come to America. I said, I'll stay a year, 2 years, learn the language, and come back. And from the moment that I came to New York, I adored New York. I loved it, and I stayed. So it was certainly a decision that I took as an adult, to decide to stay here, and I became an American citizen 5 years later. And certainly, it's been very good to me, but in that context, I am certainly as American, maybe more American than some people who happen to be born here by chance. I choose it as an adult to be who I am. You
feel American.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Let me thank the caller.
Of course, my accent is more from Connecticut than from here.
Yeah, I hear the Connecticut in your voices. A couple of callers asking about cheaper meals. Maureen says, I picked up a copy of Cuisine Economique a few years ago, written during the early 90s economic downturn. And I've been wondering for a few months whether Mr. Pepin is thinking about offering some insights for great and thrifty meals from that repertoire. Another listener says, your sense of humor and practical approach to cooking seem to make you the perfect person to take an up-to-date look at this niche cuisine, given the current economic situation. I think more people than ever will be looking to eat on a low budget.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point, you know, because as a chef, you know, you apply your knowledge toward a specific area of food. And I had a column in the New York Times for about 7-8 years, which was called The Purposeful Cook, and which I did that book called Cuisine Economic out of it. And it was to cook for a family of six with the minimal amount of money. And we are planning, actually, discussing a show now where I would do some of those. It's always fun, as I say, for a chef to try. I did a book for the Cleveland Clinic for cardiac patient weight loss as well. So the focus would be totally, totally different. But if you have a certain knowledge in a subject, as I say, it's nice to focus it to a certain area of food and try to do something well with it. So, yes, we're thinking about that. And it's fun. I mean, I am, by definition, very thrifty in the kitchen, even miserly, you know, so I don't really. When I was first married, and that 43 years that I've been married, the only discussion we would have with my wife is that I would go a couple of days in one place or another, and I come back, open the refrigerator, and the stuff from 3 days ago was still there. And I say, how come you didn't use that? What did you use that first before we start using this and that? So we had those stupid arguments about this. So after so many years, when I come to home, the refrigerator is clean. I don't know if she throws it out before I get here, but we don't have those arguments anymore.
Do you know about California's Proposition 2, which is on the November 4th ballot?
Uh-huh.
That would allow more room for chickens, more space for them to in the farms.
That I would vote for that right away. I mean, you know, I remember reading somewhere that to start with, for example, you go to Greece, place like this, where there is an enormous amount of certain type of grass that they eat, and the little leaf that we have also, I have in my garden in Connecticut, which is, the name just escaped me, but it's very high in omega-3, and the eggs there are almost as high as salmon because of purslane, they graze only on purslane. Without any question, the quality is totally different. And for me, as I said before, a chicken should be respected, and if have more space. I also read that in those places where you have 4,000 or 5,000 chicken confined to an area, the noise itself is so atrocious that they realize that by putting acoustic tile, just lowering the noise by 20-30% without even changing the diet, they lower the cholesterol in the eggs by 5, 6, or 10 points, just because of the stress factor. So,
Tom, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michael. Love your show and great program this morning. Jacques Pepin, in your book, your autobiography, which I adored, you said one of your favorite meals, or maybe your most favorite meal growing up, was when you went with your brothers fishing and you had the wild-caught minnows with some fresh bread. What do you think of the Vietnamese-French cuisine, especially the pork on baguette, the toasted sourdough baguette? mm-hmm. with the hot, really hot horseradish. And they also have crepes wrapped with, you know, wrapping pork and shrimp and mint leaves and things like that,
yes,
which I think
yes.
is also, you know, fusion.
Oh, I love Vietnamese cooking. Actually, when I came to this country, I was not too familiar with Chinese cooking, which I adore now, like any other type of Oriental
cooking. Any preference
cooking.
Between, but say, Hunan or Cantonese? Or
I
Mandarin
like usually
or?
Hot.
You, like
you know,
hot,
I would
yeah.
take the Yunnan. But I was relatively familiar with Vietnamese cooking because of the French occupation of Vietnam for many years. In Paris, on the left bank, certainly, Rue Monsieur Le Prince, there is a lot of Vietnamese restaurants who existed already before I left France. So it was pretty familiar to me, and I love it. And they really took some good things from the French, how do you say, the baguette or artichokes or many things that they combined with their own seasoning. It started to be po, you know, the beef soup that is served in the street in Saigon and all that. It's really good.
Yeah, I loved your free-range wedding ceremony, too, where everything was taken off the land and from the sea.
Oh, yes, that was fun, yes. Yeah,
thank
that
you,
was
Tom.
Fun. I had all my friends foraging, you know, for wild mushroom, for frog legs, for...
You gotta be careful looking for mushrooms, though.
No, I have my wife test it first.
She's the taster, I understand.
No.
Here's Ted who writes, please ask your guest what he thought of the movie Ratatouille and tell him his recipe for searing salmon skin side down with only salt and pepper and olive oil is the most divine way to prepare and eat salmon.
Thank you very much.
Did you see Ratatouille?
Yeah, I saw Ratatouille, yes. I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, the chef really reminded me of old chef that I worked with in Paris. And I think the food critic was really fun, too. I mean, the whole thing was quite amusing and interesting to me.
It's always fun and interesting to have you here. And again, Jacques Pepin's new book is More Fast Food My Way. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And we do appreciate your listenership. Thank you for it. I want to thank also our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.